Welcome back to the Original Gangsters Podcast. I'm Jimmy Bucciolato. My partner in crime and co-conspirator Scott Bernstein is not in the studio today. He's actually in Las Vegas. He's getting down with the Mob Museum in Vegas, so he'll be here next week. But we're happy to have a guest co-host today, special guest co-host, Daniel Waugh, who is an esteemed author and crime historian. I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with his books. Off Color is a book he wrote about the Purple Gang. Venita, a book about the Italian Mafia. He wrote Gangs of St. Louis. Egan's Rats. He's got another book coming out. He's a Detroit guy. So we're going to hold it down. Bernie's not here, but we've got Dan in studio. I'm with you guys. So we're going to talk about old school Detroit gangsters today. Prohibition era gangsters, the Purple Gang, some stuff about the Italian Mafia. So anyhow, welcome, Dan. Happy to have you in here.
Yeah, thanks, Jimmy. Thanks a lot for having me.
So I think the point of departure here, I think, should be the Purple Gang. That's the most recognizable organized crime group, I think, if we're talking about Detroit during the Prohibition era. So tell us a little bit about the Purple Gang, Dan. I mean, who were these guys? Where were they from? What kinds of crimes were they involved in? And then we'll get into more like specific stuff about it. But just give us a general outline of who they were.
Sure. The Purple Gang, they were almost exclusively Jewish Americans. Some of them were born overseas in what was then known as the Pale of Settlement, a section of what was then Russia, Poland, Austria-Hungary, that kind of thing. But quite a few of them were born here in Detroit in the old Jewish neighborhood, which used to be called Little Jerusalem. It was located a couple blocks east and west of Hastings Street, north of Gratiot. Hastings Street was the main drag. And a lot of them grew up together, and a lot of them went to the same school. It was called the Bishop Ungraded School. There was a regular school, and then there was an ungraded trade school for incorrigible students next door. Of course, they all went to that one.
That makes sense.
And they committed a bunch of juvenile crimes as kids. One myth about how they got their name was that they robbed a couple of pushcart vendors on Hastings Street. And one of them supposedly marked to the other, "Those bad boys are bad, they're tainted." The other one said, "Yeah, they're tainted, off color, like a Purple Gang." That's how they supposedly got their name. Even though it was almost certainly an invention of a newspaper
writer. Sure.
But it sounds cool.
Yeah.
As they grew older, they attracted the attention of a bunch of Jewish mobsters who had moved out to Detroit from New York, the Lower East Side. Michigan started Prohibition about 2 years before the rest of America did. It started in here in Michigan, the state of Michigan, in May of 1918. Booze was completely outlawed. And these guys came out here from New York and decided to make some easy money in the liquor business, because anybody could see that the 16th Amendment would soon be made into law.
And plus you could, one of the reasons why I think it was so ridiculous to have Prohibition here early, although they knew it would go federal eventually. I mean, the people who were advocating Prohibition knew that eventually it would be a universal law. But in the meantime, what was ridiculous about it was you could just go to Toledo or Windsor.
Exactly.
bring booze into Detroit, mm-hmm. Which is not very far, right? Either way, pretty close to us. So I know that a lot of the early examples of bootlegging, it wasn't like, you know, guys manufacturing their own bootleg liquor. It was just smuggling it from Canada and Ohio.
There was smuggling, but a lot of people did do their own cooking.
Oh, like moonshine kind of thing?
Yeah. In fact, two of the older guys that came out from New York that I was just talking about, one of them was named Jake Traeger, and he set up like whiskey stills all
that's
around
right.
Little Jerusalem.
Oh yeah, I think you talked about, okay, I remember that, yeah.
It's kind of a low-rent way to do it, I mean, because the quality was often pretty shitty.
Right.
But it was easy to produce, and it was easy to camouflage. And see, that's the thing about the Purple Gang. They never really got that much into smuggling, especially in the early years. They were much more reliant on hijacking.
Ah,
they'd let other people smuggle it across the river in the dead of night. And as they're unloading their booze, the Purple Gang would come out of the shadows and stick them up.
Yeah.
And if they've resisted, of course, they killed them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Because the underworld landscape at the time, we talk about the Jewish Purple Gang, the Italian Mafia, but everyone was in on it. It wasn't like just a couple of ethnic groups. I mean, even mom and pop people were cooking up. And even just anyone who could make a buck could go over to Windsor and try to smuggle something over in a toboggan or something when the lake was river was frozen.
Oh, yeah.
So everyone was in on it. So what my overall point is, it would be easy for the Purple Gang to pick off a lot of these people smuggling booze who were not as well equipped or well armed to
Purple Gang. That's the thing. It's like, you know, plenty of people. Well, you know, average Joes, like you said, looking to make a few easy bucks in the liquor business would find themselves at the mercy of ruthless guys like the Purple Gang, and it often had, you know, tragic results.
Yeah. So the guys you're talking about, the early guys, is this the same thing as like the Sugar House, Oakland Sugar House, or is that different than the...
Actually, there's a lot of confusion about that. And that's what I try to straighten out in my book.
Yeah,
is that
yeah,
all
go
these
ahead.
Different subgroups, like the Oakland Sugar House Gang, the Third Street Terrors, the Third Street Navy, they all basically consisted of the same individuals.
Okay.
The Oakland Sugar House Gang would probably be their original name in like the very early 20s. They got that name. There was a sugar warehouse on Oakland Avenue where that was run by a guy, one of the New Yorkers by the name of Isidore Cantor and his partner, George Goldberg. At this sugar warehouse, they sold corn sugar sacks, which were an important ingredient for homemade moonshining. Now, Isidore Cantor, he was basically, I don't know if I go so far as to call him a gangster, but he was basically a regular guy. That's how he saw himself, who sold sugar. What people do with it, you know, after I sell it to them, that's their business. I'm not breaking the law. All of the young purple gangsters, many of whom, quite frankly, were just in their late teens or early 20s at the time, they started working out of his place on Oakland Avenue. But Oakland Avenue was very close to Hamtramck, which is where a particularly powerful Italian mobster named Chester Lamar was then operating. And Chester Lamar saw that, like, Isidore Cantor was making all these money and all these illegal moonshine stills around Little Jerusalem, and he moved in to try to extort them. And that's what touched off the first gang war that the Purple Gang was involved in 1923.
So let me just so we can get our individuals straight here. So the main guys that we think of in the Purple Gang, like the Bernstein brothers and some of those dudes, at this point, they're still younger dudes coming up under like Cantor and those.
Most of them were. Abe was the oldest. Abe was significantly older.
Okay.
Abe, in 1923, Abe Bernstein was already 32.
Okay, so he wasn't a young Turk
at this
point. So, by the way, these I think a lot of people listening to this are probably aware, but Scott Bernstein, our esteemed colleague, he's related. The Bernstein.
Really too bad he isn't here for this one.
Yeah, I know, of all episodes, right. So, but tell us about, because, I've always been under the impression that for the most part, the Italians and the Purples, I wouldn't say they were best buds, but they
coexisted,
either stayed out of each other's way, maybe sometimes even dealt with each other. But you're saying at this early point, there was actually conflict. And I mean, maybe not, this is something we get, when it go down this rabbit hole, you and I talk about in my book, Early Organized Crime in Detroit, in your book, In Venita, in terms of 1923, what is the mafia, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is Chester Lamar, is that even really what we think of as the mafia, like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That's a difficult subject, but he was definitely an Italian gangster.
Yes.
Whether he was official mafia yet or not, you know, I think probably by 23, we would say he was.
Yeah, he was.
I would think so.
It's,
but
it's kind of an anomaly because he wasn't Sicilian.
Right.
And the mafia in Detroit almost exclusively didn't admit.
Right.
You know, mainland Italians at that point.
Even today.
Yeah. But, Lamar was there. He's right in the middle of it with the Gianolas. He Swiss-sized a whole bunch of times in their war that he had. I mean, he's quite a fascinating figure. He could probably be worthy of his own biography if anybody ever decided
I think so as well. So he gets into conflict with these Jewish bootleggers. So tell us about that. I interrupted you, but go back to that if you can.
Chester Lemaire was a classic extortionist. In the late teens, one of the early places where like the young purple gangsters were hanging around on Hastings Street was a gambling den called the Working Man's Cafe. It's an illegal gambling hall that was ran out of the back of a dry goods store on Hastings Street. Of course, Chester Lemaire got wind of it, and he extorted these two Jewish gamblers who were working there. The head guy was used the name Joe Murphy. No one seems to know what his, you know, Hebraic name was. It's lost in the sands of time. Of course, you know, Joe Murphy may be a tough guy, but he's no Chester Lemaire. You know, what the hell is he going to do?
Right.
And so he pays protection. And eventually, a group of rival Sicilians tried to kill Chester Lemaire outside the Working Man's Cafe. He had to leave town for a while. But long and the short of it is, Chester Lemaire had dealt with these Jewish gangsters on Hastings Street before, and he considered them to be soft and weak. You know, easy pickings.
Yeah.
So when he went in and sent the around to extort some of the Jewish moonsigners in Little Jerusalem, Jake Traeger basically told him to go fuck himself. So Chester Lemaire had him killed on Hastings Street. Then Chester Lemaire sets his sights on the Sugar House on Oakland Avenue. Once again, Isidore Cantor tells him to go fuck himself. A couple days later, Isidore Cantor runs into one of Chester Lemaire's guys on Hastings Street, a guy by the name of Frank Speed. Supposedly, he was supposed to be real quick on the trigger of a pistol. Well, he wasn't quick enough because Isidore Cantor pulled a gun and shot him dead. Got ruled to be justifiable homicide. Police even granted him a permit to carry a gun. Isidore Cantor started getting a whole bunch of death threats, but see the thing about Isidore Cantor, he didn't believe in any gangster code of silence. He had no problem talking to the press.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, you know, this piece of shit guy who I won't name in Hamtramck's trying to cut in my hard-earned money, I'm not going to let that happen. If he wants trouble, he'll find it.
Yeah.
Well, of course, Chester Lemaire one night sends a bunch of his guys past the Oakland Sugar House and shoots the place to shreds. I'm even convinced that they used an automatic weapon in it. Maybe a good 3 or 4 years before machine guns became noticeable.
Right.
The evidence is unclear.
Yeah.
But Isidore Cantor is wounded. Another one of his guys is killed. A couple ladies that they were partying with are shot. It's actually a pretty big shooting. It was just around Labor Day of 23 that this happened. And Isidore Cantor's laid up in the hospital, recovering, gives another press conference. You know, that son of a bitch, blah, blah, blah. But see, while this is happening, some of the guys that work with Izzy, guys like Charlie Leiter and Henry Shore and Abe Bernstein, they're looking. I was like, okay, what is it with this guy? He needs to tone it down a little bit. But the shooting war continued. And some of the young purple gangsters, Harry Fleischer was one, cut his teeth in this war as far as murdering. Finally, the Italians caught up with Isidore Cantor. He went out to New York in February of 24 to arrange for a damaged automobile to be shipped back to Detroit or whatever. And one of his friends betrayed him, and they fished him out of the East River a couple months later.
So was that because Bernstein and the other guys, Leiter and them, did they make an arrangement with the Italians? Like, if we get rid of this dude and you could get Lemaire to calm the fuck down, maybe we can go back to, like...
That's a definite possibility. It's impossible to know at this late
right.
date, but yeah, it's...
Right.
I could definitely see something like that happening.
Yeah. So I'm just fascinated by the politics of this. And I know Scott would geek out on this too. if Lemaire is in a, as we would say in Italiano, Cesare Lemaire, Chester Lemaire, if he's in a shooting war with the purples, or at least the proto purples, in 23, who's the Don at that point? Is that Caruso?
It would be Ignacio Caruso at that point.
So how much autonomy does Lemaire have to, like,
I get the impression, you know what I mean? That I get the impression that he has a decent amount, because I think that that's kind of like the deal that they worked out in 21.
Right.
When the Gianola Vitale war finally petered out after God knows how many people had been killed.
Yeah, right, right.
I get the impression that you and I have talked about this before, that Ignacio Caruso, he might have been the boss in name.
I see.
I get the impression that he's more of like a figurehead.
Yeah.
Especially given the way the war ended.
Yeah.
And that Catalanotti was actually the one pulling the strings.
Yeah.
Until another year or two later, when he just got rid of Caruso altogether and said, you know what, I'm in charge now. You're on the sidelines.
Right. Because I'm just, and Lemaire was in league with Catalanotti, right? They weren't they part of like the same faction, the West Side faction?
How it started with this, Lamar started out with the Giannolas. He flipped to the Vitales, which was that kind of Talinati was
right.
That side. Then in around 1920 or so, Lamar became a third party in the war. He had his own crew of mainland Italian gangsters. So he kind of half-assed, made his own bid for leadership of the family, if you
right.
will. The police called them the Romans.
Right.
Because yeah. because they weren't Sicilian.
Right. Okay. So back to the purple. So they survived this shooting war. Well, not all of them. but Bernstein, A. Bernstein, his brothers, Fleischer, some of the other heavyweights. At what point do we start thinking of them as not like affiliates of like the Oakland Sugar House gang, but like the purple gang, like their own Jewish syndicate?
They really started to come into their own after that war ended, because they settled into a good working relationship with the Sicilians, you know, because guys like Bernstein, Charlie Leiter, Henry Shore, it's like, you know what? There's plenty of money for all of us. You know, we can work with you. And guys like Italianati, they said, you know, amen.
Yeah,
absolutely. We can do business. And that's where that mutual respect between the Purples and the Sicilians really started to come into play. At that point, they really started to take off in the mid-20s. The name Purple, the earliest reference to the name Purple Gang that I could find was a newspaper article in January of 1928.
It's pretty late. I would have thought it was earlier, but yeah.
There was a...
I mean, obviously you're the expert. I'm not challenging you.
No, not at all.
I'm just saying, like, that strikes me as... If you were to just ask me on the street, I would assume it was a few years earlier than that. Mm-hmm. That's pretty interesting.
The name might have been coined by Inspector Henry Garvin.
Oh, yeah.
There was a Detroit news reporter named Jack Carlisle. Great guy. He worked the crime beat during Prohibition. That Pete Licavoli liked him so much, he actually took him along on a rum-running expedition once.
Field research.
Yeah, Carlisle, years later, when they interviewed him in the early 80s for a newspaper series about the Purple Gang, he said that he didn't name the inspector, but he said, yeah, the name came from a particularly colorful Detroit police inspector who loved to talk to the press. And who was that? That's Henry Garvin. That guy lived to talk to the press.
Yeah.
But the name came around in January of 28. There were a couple of Detroit cops. One was named Max Wisman and the other was named Vivian Welch. And they were shaking down alley breweries in Detroit's North End. That was a big racket for the Purple Gang. Basically, breweries that would be like in garages and barns that were to the rear of residences. They'd homebrew beer there and sell it around the neighborhood. And of course, these two cops go around and shake them down for protection money. Wisman gets caught, gets fired off the force, but Welch escapes detection. So he's still making the extortion rounds. Finally, you know, the Bernstein and the bosses said, you know what? We don't give a shit that this guy's a fucking cop. You know, if he wants to swim in the deep end of the pool, he's going to drown.
Yeah.
And so they ended up killing him in right on the Hamtramck Detroit City line. I think what happened was is that they were trying to get him across into Detroit to knock him off there, just kind of as a courtesy to the Detroit police or whatever.
Yeah.
And so in the heat from that murder, which of course naturally was never solved, that's when the name Purple Gang first appeared in a newspaper, an article, the Detroit Times, a paper which, you know, no longer exists.
Right.
But yeah, like I said, they're quoting an anonymous Detroit police inspector saying that how the notorious Purple Gang is under suspicion in the murder of, you know, Officer Vivian Welch, blah, blah, blah.
Well, where do you think he got that term from? Because this is after the, was it Cleaners and Dryers War?
Yeah, there's another story that, like, in some instances of their like, terrorization of Detroit's cleaning and dyeing industry.
Right.
That they would ruin truckloads of clothes by tossing cans of purple paint on them.
Right.
That's definitely feasible. One of their top members who came out here from New York was a guy named Eddie Fletcher, who was actually a professional boxer in New York.
Yeah.
Featherweight. Fought in Madison Square Garden.
Wow.
You talk about a wrong turn. But
yeah.
There, when he came out here to Detroit, all the boys knew who he was. And it's like, you know, why don't you put the gloves on one last time? Let's see you in action. So he goes over to a place on the east side, Fairview and Mac. And when he came out to fight, him and his seconds were all wearing purple jerseys.
Oh.
That's another speculation of how the name came around.
God, it's fascinating though, because I don't think we'll ever know. You know what I mean?
That's what I say in my book. It's like, no, I even say like in the first sentence of the first chapter, nobody knows where the hell the name came from.
Yeah, right.
Because all the possibilities.
All of those are plausible, right? So how self-aware were they? Like, okay, so law enforcement, they're calling them the Purple Gang. The media, they're going to run with that as a nice ring to it. How self-aware are they? Are Bernstein and these guys, are they like, yeah, we're the Purple Gang? I mean, what would you say?
When some of them got busted, there was a big bust in May of 1929, and one of their number, Joe Honey Miller, who's actually Sicilian, by the way, his real name is Giuseppe Maragliata. Oh, that was a colorful guy. Oh, God, he had picture. He had gold cap teeth in his mouth. I mean, you know, he eventually wound up in Eloy's, the mental hospital.
Yeah.
And they asked him about it. He basically lost his shit. He ranted and raved to the newspaper, man. Every time I go around, people are talking about the Purple Gang. I mean, who the hell got up that name? Yeah, they just kind of shrugged their shoulders at it. They said, it's the same thing as St. Louis. They say, Egan's Rats this, Egan's Rats that. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, it was... So they were just viewing it as, hey, we're just doing our thing. And you want to call us Purple Gang, whatever.
Right.
But that's different than like... the Italian mafia, which is, this is Cosa Nostra, like that, like you either are Cosa Nostra or you're not.
Right.
You look at, other groups like the Japanese Yakuza, right. Those are very distinct. Like you either are a member or you're not. The Purple Gang never endorsed that kind of, or internalized that kind of logic.
And it worked against them in the end because they were so loosely organized.
Yeah.
I like to describe the Purple Gang as being in like tiers. The top tier gangsters would be obviously the Bernsteins, the Fleischers, Henry Shore, Charlie Leiter, Sam Garfield. Second tier would be like, you know, the heavy hitters like Abe Axler, Eddie Fletcher, Joe Honey Miller, Irving Milberg, etc. Third tier would be like, you know, the young guys you don't really know, like Ziggy Selwyn would probably be like the top third tier gangster. He was the guy who like was drinking in a blind pig, got drunk, saw a diamond ring on one barfly's hand. He's like, give me your fucking ring. Guy tells him, you know, piss off. So Irving, you know, Selwyn cracks him over the head with a beer bottle and whips out a switchblade and just lops the guy's finger right off. And took the ring. He also killed his brother-in-law too, right in front of his family in April of 1928. Man. Yeah. He was a little trigger happy as the adjective I'd use.
I want to talk about how violent they were in a moment, but back to the politics of the situation, talking about a disadvantage. So, you know, we always know there's exceptions to all these so-called rules, but in the Italian mafia, if you put your hands on a made guy, there's supposedly going to be retaliation from possibly the whole organization. Which would give you that's one of the advantages, one of the perks of being a part of that fraternity, right? Whereas, so like with the Purples, I can see that as an advantage where maybe one of the second tier or first tier or, you know, the lower tier Purples, someone, even if it's some Joe Blow in the bar, puts their hands on him, he's kind of on his, I mean, and these guys were tough guys who could handle themselves, but you know, you never know. They could run into somebody who's more formidable and, they're still basically on their own, right? There'd be no like code where he could go to Abe Bernstein, go to the Don and be like, this guy put his hands on me. And
it wouldn't be an official thing. I mean, he could probably squawk up the ladder if he wanted to.
Sure.
Maybe something would happen. Maybe it wouldn't.
Right.
Or knowing how the Purple Gang was, he might just decide to handle it on his own.
Right.
For the hell of it.
Yeah. Or what would get their attention, the leadership would be if there's a financial interest in,
yeah, that's
you,
the big
you
thing.
Helping me helping me settle this, right? But if it's just me getting in a bar fight, they might be like, "That's your own problem," you know. So let's talk about, because I think we think about the Purple Gang as one of the reasons why they're so infamous and notorious and well known is because of how violent they were. And you're already talking about this, even as you know, as early as 1923 or even before that, you're talking about the Vitale Gianola War. Which was an internal war within the Detroit Mafia. Extremely violent. And when I was doing the research for my book And I think you'll agree with me. I was really struck at how violent things were between these gangsters. And it makes me think of, I don't want to get too like down the sociological rabbit hole here, but I think there's a narrative for some people in this city who are maybe older than 50, in their 60s, 70s, maybe even 40s, that Detroit, there was a golden age. It was a peaceful, prosperous place. And then after 67, it all went to hell, and it's just nothing but a fairy tale. Yeah, right. And there's no question that Detroit is a violent city. I mean, just statistically today, there's no question about that. But to think that this is something that started after 67 is not true.
This has always been a very tough town.
Yeah.
And it can be very hard on certain people, as we've seen.
Yeah, because, I mean, when I was going through the newspaper archives, I mean, and I think you'll back me up, pretty much every day there were murders.
Yeah.
Every day. And I don't know if anyone's ever compared the data, and I don't know if you could even do that. I mean, you'd have to, the police records are gone. You'd have to do like a content analysis through the newspapers and death records. And I don't know if anyone would have the time to do that, but I wonder statistically how it compares with how violent the city is today, because I bet it's comparable if you adjust for population and things like that.
Yeah, I think I kind of half-assed did this about 10 years ago, just like I'm my own. It wasn't an official thing, but the totals were about equal to today, maybe even a hair more violent in the past.
Yeah.
Maybe in like the 80s or 90s, like during, you know, when crack was at its height.
Yeah.
Then the modern period might have eclipsed the old days.
Yeah.
But yeah, nowadays, in the 2020s, I would definitely say that 100 years ago was more violent.
Yeah, it was really striking to me. And not even just, I don't want to digress too much, but not even, I mean, I was interested in the gangster stuff, but even just the same kind of shit here now, like husband kills wife with an axe and like mother kills her kid, like same fucked up shit.
Oh yeah. The Evangelista murders on St. Aubyn.
Right.
Psycho goes into the house and slaughters a family with an axe, six people. And there are hints of like maybe some kind of a weird cult like religion.
Yeah.
That Evangelista is pretty, I mean, that is like a whole, and it's still unexplained. The police had a prime suspect who died of natural causes, maybe like 5 years later. I can't think of the fella's name right off the bat, but who the hell knows if it was him or not.
Yeah.
Or why this happened. I mean, it'd definitely be worthy of some further investigation.
No, I agree. That's a fascinating case study. And my overall point is not to excuse the kind of violence that's going on now, because I agree it's bad, and we need to think of constructive ways on how to reduce that. But there's no point in romanticizing a period that never existed.
Exactly.
And comparing it to
every now and again, I'll see something on the internet about how gangsters of old are classier this and that. I was like, fucking please, shut the hell up.
Right. Yeah, I know that Scott Bernstein, I mean, he gets this at a lot of his book talks, where he, especially when he's talking to Jewish groups, and he says that there's this response that like, well, the purple gangs, those were the good gangsters. They were the Robin Hood, and they were defending the community. Yeah. And Scott's always like, no, they were just as cutthroat, ruthless as any other group.
I even say that in the introduction of my book. It's like, anybody who thinks that the old days were, but just remember that on one occasion, the purple gang went down to Cleveland, grabbed two guys who had killed one of theirs, and basically beat the shit out of them with a hammer, caved their skulls in, then stabbed them through the brain with an ice pick.
Yeah.
And one of the guys actually, his bowels voided as he died.
Yeah.
Very classy.
Does that sound like a code of honor? And so let's talk about like some of the more infamous cases of violence, because some of the most infamous hits, gangland hits, were related to the Purple Gang, like the massacre at the apartment complex. You want to tell us about that?
Yeah, there was a couple of them.
Right.
In March of 27, the Miraflores massacre was done in response to the killings of some Purple associates. One of them was a Purple Gang liquor distributor named Johnny Reed, who came here from St. Louis. He was a former member of Vegan's Rats. And Johnny Reed had got into it with a rogue Sicilian gangster by the name of Mike DePisa. They shot it out over a couple of weeks in the summer of 1926, and DePisa got his ass whipped to the point where he basically came to the peace treaty and gave up a couple of his guys to be killed in order to save his own skin. But a couple months later, DePisa comes back, brings in a guy from Chicago who kills Johnny Reed. This guy was named Frank Wright. He was Polish. I never was able to find out his true name. But Frank Wright killed another Purple Gang liquor distributor named Jake Weinberg. And then that really got the Purples pissed off. They set a trap for him, and they brought in one of Johnny Reed's buddies, who is known to underworld history as Fred Killer Burke.
Oh, yeah.
And they lured them, Frank Wright and a couple of his guys, to the Miraflores apartments, and Burke mowed them down with machine gun fire. It was the first instance of a confirmed instance of a Thompson submachine gun being used in the Detroit underworld.
Yeah, I mean, so you've talked about a drive-by shooting of the Oakland Sugar House gang. Mm-hmm. Here we have using a fully automatic, to slaughter some people. So much for the good old days, gentlemen gangsters.
The bad old days.
Right. I mean, this is some of the most violent shit for its time, right? Like,
yeah.
Because, correct me if I'm wrong, like, Chicago, eventually the Tommy gun becomes, like,
standard issue.
Notorious, right, for that. But actually, you could say some of that we saw here earlier, right?
Yeah. As much as it popular with and as effective as it was, the Thompson submachine gun wasn't quite as popular with gangsters as, like, Hollywood makes it out to be. Tommy guns back then were like assault rifles would be nowadays. A couple guys are really skilled with them and know how to use them, but like for close work, 9 times out of 10, they'll probably just use a handgun or maybe a sawed-off shotgun.
Yeah. No, that makes sense, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they look cool, but they're not necessarily practical. I mean, on the battlefield maybe, but like, but when we're talking about gangland hits, you're right. Usually it's a matter of stealth, mm-hmm. right? I mean, although we know of like examples where they shoot up the place, but a lot of that I think is more so from like James Cagney movies and things like that. Mm-hmm. When they want to whack a guy, it's more likely back then, just like with the mafia today, they're going to lure someone somewhere, mm-hmm. ambush them and use a small firearm.
Right.
Right. So, but in this case, they did use a Tommy gun.
There was the Third Street Terrors were a group of Jewish gangsters that came out of Chicago. Jules Leibovitz, Izzy Sutker, and Jaime Paul were their names. They attached themselves to the Purple Gang and eventually went off on their own. They did bootlegging down around Corktown. There was an Irish group out of Corktown led by a guy named Bernie Doherty who hijacked, I'm trying to remember, the Third Street Terrors, the Jewish guys from Chicago, hijacked some of the Irish crew's booze. The Irish guys went over to their warehouse in the middle of the night to get the booze back, but Leibovitz and the others discovered them, so they hopped in one of their trucks and chased after the Irish guy's car, and they started ramming it with a truck. And while they're ramming the car with the truck, Joe Leibovitz is leaning out of the passenger side window with a Thompson submachine gun, throwing bullets at him, and ended up killing one of them. That's something that you would almost like never see outside of like a gangster movie,
but it
actually happened.
Right,
right on 8th Street. In fact, probably just a couple blocks away from where Tiger Stadium used to be. That's where this went down.
So, the Irish gangsters in Corktown, Doherty, and what about was, who was the other guy? Was it Tallman? Who was the other?
Tallman was...
Was he Irish gangster too?
He...
Because he was in Corktown, wasn't he? That doesn't mean he was Irish, a little bit
north of Corktown.
Okay.
He was like Midtown area.
Okay.
That's where I would put Tallman at.
Yeah.
Joe Tallman, I think his father was originally from England. I don't know if he was necessarily Irish.
Okay.
They were just kind of like, I don't know, just... There was a couple, kind of like a mixed bag.
So would you say the Irish gangsters in Detroit, or bootleggers, whatever they were, they didn't seem to exert the same kind of influence or scale like the Irish did in Chicago?
No, not at all.
Or even in St. Louis too, right?
Right. Yeah, the Doherty gang was pretty small potatoes.
Okay.
You know, in fact, after this incident with the truck ramming and the machine gunning, Bernie Doherty went away to prison. And the Third Street Terrors had to leave town for a while because they got fingered in another murder. And while they were gone, the Purple Gang took over booze distribution for Corktown.
So, and then what was the other major massacre?
That would be the Collingwood Manor massacre, September of 31. When the Third Street Terrors, their number finally came up.
Yes.
They got a little overextended. basically what happened was is that they had been fallen on hard times by 31. Pretty much the only thing keeping them afloat was like a handbook that they ran. So the Sicilian mob from the east side, they started hitting up their handbook for fixed horse races and, you know, basically stealing a whole bunch of money out of their business. In order to pay off these bettors, the Third Street Terrors started buying pure alcohol on credit, not only from the Purple Gang, but from different mafia crews, both on the east side and downriver. And they just got so overextended. It's like, it's only a matter of time before they get knocked
off. Somebody's going to kill them.
But, you know, all of, you know, as always, a deuce ass machina comes down from the sky when you're at your most trouble. Ray Bernstein comes like, you know what? We're going to take you guys on board, make you full partners, the whole nine yards. You know, why don't you meet me over at the Collingwood Apartments? We'll discuss it. You know, of course, at the Root Three Terrors, who are never going to do the game show circuit. You know, that's like, yeah, let's go.
Yeah, right.
The only thing was they took a guy with them named Sally Levine. Sally Levine was a good friend of Ray Bernstein's and probably helped let the Third Street Terrors let their guard down a little bit. Mm-hmm. So they go to the apartment. Harry Fleischer's there, as is Harry Keywell and Irving Milberg. And Ray Bernstein says, you know, hey, where's Scotty at with the books? Let me go give him a call. So he leaves the apartment, then goes out to the car and starts honking the horn. That's a signal. So Fleischer and the others pull guns and shoot the Third Street Terrors right dead right there on the couch. But they left Sally Levine alive. That's the kicker, because he's Ray Bernstein's buddy. Their decision to leave him alive, which would really come back to bite them in the ass, but more on that in a second, was part of a plan to frame him for the murders. Oh, okay. What they were going to do is take Sally Levine out of there, plant his fingerprints on one of the murder weapons used in the massacre, kill Sally Levine, and plant that hot gun on him and said, hey, police, there's your
yeah.
Only thing was the police got Sally Levine before the Purples did. And, you know, after about 36 hours or so in the quote-unquote goldfish bowl, Sally spilled his guts. Bernstein and Keelwell and Merle Begg, they all got busted. Harry Fleischer is the only one who managed to make it out of town. And all three of those guys got life in prison.
Yeah, I was going to say that was Ray Bernstein. Yep. Right. By the time he got out of prison, he wasn't alive. He didn't live for much longer after that because he was an older dude.
Yeah, he had a stroke in the spring of 1963 by the time he got a mercy parole.
Yeah.
And he was immediately admitted to U of M Medical Center in Ann Arbor, where he died a couple years later.
And he was the only Bernstein Purple, I think, who did significant time. Is that correct?
Yeah. Scott and I talked about Ray basically took it on the chin for the sins of all of them.
Yeah, right. And then the other three, Joe, Abe, and what was the other?
Izzy.
Yeah. Those guys, I think they were arrested before, but did they ever do time? I don't know.
No, none of them ever did
anything. I mean, I know they were like time in some of those, you know, well-publicized trials, you know, they were arrested. And
yeah, they
like
they that, beat but, every major case and, yeah.
Right. So, pretty violent era and just the landscape you're describing, think about how precarious it was to be then to try to run a card game, a bootlegging operation, a brothel. I mean, talk about like kill or be killed. Mm-hmm. Like all these, you think you're a bad motherfucker involved in the underworld and there's other dudes who are like ready to take you out and take your action. I mean, pretty scary.
Yeah. It's
you know what I mean?
Like I said, yeah, you choose to swim with sharks, eventually you're going to get bit somehow.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, especially with these heavy hitters out there, the Purples, the Italian Mafia, others. So before we get to like the sort of, this is like the rise of the Purple Gang and their you know, well-known status, and we'll get to the fall, but the overall landscape, so we know we've already established there's an Italian Mafia, there's an Irish group. Maybe they were marginal, but they were there. Were there any other ethnic crime groups? I mean, didn't the Polish have somewhat of a gang?
There was a safe-cracking gang out of Hamtramck that was primarily Polish in makeup.
Was that the Jaworski gang or something like that?
They were armed robbers out of Pennsylvania.
Okay.
These safe-crackers were known as the Lizard Gang.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, I remember that. Yeah, okay.
There was also... the Black Numbers operation as well in Paradise Valley, which was actually run by John Roxborough.
Oh, yeah.
The very wealthy man who published a newspaper called the Detroit Owl.
Yeah.
And who was Joe Louis's first manager.
If there were gentlemen gangsters back then, which we find dubious, he would be
one of them.
He would be one of them. If there, yeah. to the extent that that was a real, that was a real thing. So that's the landscape. And then of course there were just miscellaneous, you know, that not really defined by any kind of ethnic grouping, right? Just
like, like Joe Tallman would be one of those guys.
Yeah. Right. And, was it, who was it? Legs Lehman.
Kidnapper.
Yeah, kidnapper. So a lot of guys involved in different hustles.
Yeah, it's like the Wild West.
Yeah, I mean, right.
It's a good way to put it. The city is so close to Canada and this gold rush of illegal liquor. It's all that's separating them is that little stretch of river. I mean, what? It's not even a half mile wide.
Yeah, right.
At most.
Yeah. Right. It's too easy. Mm-hmm. Lefty Clark, right?
He was a
gambling czar or something like that.
He used to walk around downtown with a little pet monkey perched on his shoulder.
Oh, yeah. And he was like a kind of like a politically connected dude, right? Wasn't he sort of, I wouldn't say gentleman gangster, but didn't he hobnob with some like.
Yeah, he moved in an upper circles. Yeah.
I mean, as far as those kind of guys went, he was one that was more likely to be hobnobbing with upper.
Yeah, he had a casino on Grand River that was very popular in the underworld.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact address, but I want to say it's quite literally where like Motor City is like today, which would be fitting.
Yeah, right. So that's for people who aren't from Detroit, that's in the downtown area. So the Purple Gang is at the height of its power. What would you say, the early 30s?
The top of their power would be late 20s.
Late 20s.
They acquitted at the Cleaners and Dyers trial in 28. And that's pretty much the pinnacle is like 29.
Okay.
At the height of their power, everybody, they're suspected of doing the Valentine's Day massacre in Chicago, which they didn't, by the way, despite what you read on the internet.
Yeah. Yeah, that's sort of something you'll hear is that Capone imported the Purples to do that. You want to address that?
Sure. Basically, the Purple Gang got mixed up in the Valentine's Day massacre cases because they were shipping liquor to Al Capone in Chicago as a Old Log Cabin Whiskey, which was an American bourbon that was distilled in Montreal back then and smuggled across the Detroit River. That's one of the few successful smuggling operations that the Purple Gang did outside of hijacking. Mm-hmm. They were able to meet Chicago's demand for thousands and thousands of cases of booze. And naturally, of course, Bugs Moran was hijacking Al Capone's trucks. But the actual shooters in the massacre were a group of hired gunsels out of St. Louis, which included Fred Killer Burke, the same guy that did the Miraflores massacre for the Purple Gang. In fact, I mean, the Miraflores massacre was basically a rough blueprint for what was going to happen in Chicago on Valentine's
good point.
Day.
Yeah.
Basically, these St. Louis guys working with a crew of Capone gangsters from the North Side, known as the Circus Cafe Gang, guys like Claude Maddox and whatnot, they were the ones that pulled off the massacre. The massacre was basically a military-style raid that got completely out of hand and missed Bugs Moran.
Right.
Moran actually showed up as it was ending.
Yeah, ironically.
And he saw the guys coming out. According to what Moran told his relatives, he wasn't baffled by the plot so as much as, you know, his garage getting raided. But the fact is that he didn't recognize either of the fucking so-called gangsters that were coming out of there with their hands up. Not knowing what the hell was going on, he went back to his hotel.
Yeah.
Once he got there, that's when he found out what happened.
Yeah.
But the Purple Gang got involved in the case because everybody and their mother in the know was knew that Moran was hijacking those Purple Gang liquor shipments. So the Chicago police start showing mugshots of Purple Gang members to potential witnesses. There was a woman who ran a rooming house not too far from the garage where the hit took place who partially identified the mugshots of Phil and Harry Keywell as two of the guys who rented a room. And then one newspaper reporter reported that a woman a couple blocks down thought she recognized Eddie Fletcher, the boxer, as being there. But internal Chicago police paperwork says that that's completely mistaken. Mm. She never identified anybody.
Yeah.
Then once the woman, her name was Mrs. Duty, thought about it a little bit more, she's like, no, they're not really. The Keywells weren't the same guys after. And it makes sense. At the time of the massacre, Phil Keywell was 20 years old, and Harry Keywell was all of 18.
Yeah.
Capone's not going to rely on a couple of guys barely out of their teens for something.
Not something like that big.
And just that brief identification is how the Keywells and by extension the whole Purple Gang got mixed up in the Valentine's Day case and never got unmixed.
Right. But it is true that the Purples were connected to Capone. They were definitely selling
absolutely.
Booze.
Absolutely they were.
And so I think it's important if we're going to contextualize the fall of the so-called Purple Gang. I think a lot of it Or maybe the biggest case study we can find is the milkman, right? Like Henry Millman.
Oh, Millman. Oh.
Yeah. And that's what, 37, 38,
yeah. 37? Yeah. Hollywood could not have cast a better gangster than Harry Melman. I mean, he was handsome, he was charismatic, he was hard drinking.
Didn't they call him the Milkman? Wasn't that one of his nicknames or no? Did I?
I don't believe.
Did I just make that up?
No, it works.
Okay. When you get your Hollywood, we'll talk about that before we make sure we put that in. This was a nickname that we just made up. On. But yeah, go ahead. So he's a purple gang enforcer.
Yeah, a badass. He grew up in the same neighborhood as all the boys. In fact, he grew up on the same street that the Bernsteins live. Winder Street. He was charismatic, hard drinking. He's like the hero of a Calypso song. He loved every woman and whipped every man, that kind of shit. The only trouble with Harry Bowman is that, quite frankly, he was probably born about 5 or 10 years too late. By the time he hit his stride in the Harry Millen was one of the two guys who took out Abe Axler and Eddie Fletcher in 1933. He was the guy that they went up to Pontiac to meet.
Yeah.
Harry Millen was the guy who drove Abe's Chrysler to the spot on Quarton Road where they were found dead. And Harry Millen was the one who turned around from the driver's seat and popped Eddie Fletcher with a .45 automatic. So that's how he really made his bones, if you
sure. Right.
But see, here's the thing. By the time that Harry Millman hit his stride in the mid-30s, Purple Gang was really trending downward. They were falling apart. And part of that was due to the loose structure they had.
Yeah, right.
The top-tier gangsters were doing fine. Abe Bernstein was making all kinds of money.
Right.
He was in partnership.
He was getting closer to the Italians, closer to the Italians. Right.
Joe Bernstein had gotten out of the rackets because one of his underlings had actually shot him and almost killed him in an opium craze rampage back in 1930.
So he moved out west.
Yeah.
And then Abe's getting closer to the Italians. And then, right, there were some incarcerate, right? Some guys got prosecuted.
Ray's locked up, and Izzy basically followed Joe wherever he went.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Joe got out of, like, the hard stuff. According to what Scott told me, Joe Bernstein's wife, Marguerite, pulled him aside after he got shot and basically told him, it's either them or me.
Yeah. Yeah, good for her. He made the right choice.
But the lower-tier guys, like Abe Axler, Eddie Fletcher, whatnot, they're not locked up, but they don't really have any business sense. They're killers.
Yeah.
Prohibition's ending.
Good point.
We don't really, what the hell are we supposed to do?
Yeah, they're tough guys.
They're tough guys. Not to mention they're also drug addicts. They're both opium smokers. So that could have clouded their judgment as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that scene from Once Upon a Time in America with De Niro's in the opium, that is very historically accurate.
Yeah.
A lot of the purples were into opium. That was their drug of choice. So Axler and Fletcher started doing dumb shit. They tried to crash into the Sicilian mob's heroin racket. And, the bosses, they told, what the fuck are you doing? Stop that shit. Of course they don't because they're scald.
Right.
Abe Bernstein basically came up with a solution to chill everybody out. He lent Axler and Fletcher money to buy a brewery, which they would be able to legally manufacture beer after Prohibition ended in a couple months.
Yeah.
That way they'll have a living and they won't get into it with the Sicilians anymore.
Yeah.
But Abe Axler and Eddie Fletcher.
That's a pretty good deal.
Yeah, it was a win-win.
right.
But Axler and Fletcher got denied a license to legally produce alcohol by the state. They were just a little bit too notorious.
Yeah.
So Abe's like, okay, the deal fell through. Now give me that, $500,000 or whatever I gave you back. And they didn't.
That's not smart.
that was pretty much the nail in the coffin right there.
Yeah.
And
so some of the guys, so in some cases, they're killing their own guys.
Yeah.
So you got dudes that either are ill-equipped for leadership, dudes that are getting killed, dudes that are going to prison. And this is why you say, they're trending downward.
Yeah.
As if we think of it as a cohesive syndicate.
Out of all the Purple Gang members who died violently over the years, I'd say 75 to 80% of them died at the hands of their friends.
Yeah.
They were their own worst enemy.
Yeah. So at this point, Harry Millman is one of the guys who maybe tell me if this cliche is correct. He's not reading the tea leaves, right? He's not.
Right. He doesn't really care. He's finally coming to his own. He's finally trending upward.
Yeah.
And he absolutely hated the Italian mob.
Yeah, right.
With a capital H.
Right.
There's an urban myth, which I choose to believe, it's in my book, that he got into a fight with Scarface Joe Bomarito in a bar.
Right.
And by this point in time, Bomarito is a fucking captain.
Yeah, yeah.
And
notorious dude in his own right.
Yeah. Yeah, by anyone's standards, Bomarito is a cold-blooded killer. But right. Of course, Millman hated him because he was Italian and soft-handed. And
so, yeah.
Okay, Harry, have at it. Millman beats the living shit out of Bomarito in this bar fight.
Right.
Which, by any metric, signs his death warrant.
Sure.
But Millman still continues to antagonize the Italians. He shoots up their brothels, embarrasses their customers, steals money from them. Bomarito's getting a shave in a barber's chair. He walks in there, takes the hot towel and spits right in his face and runs off. I mean, it's...
Again, it's like a Hollywood script. and correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding was Abe Bernstein was trying to intervene on his behalf, saying, like, I can't protect... You're going to keep on fucking up. I can't protect you.
Yeah. Like, Abe initially tried to go to bat for Harry, but he just... No one would not quit. He was a man of rampant appetites. You know, the gas pedal was always to the floor. Yeah. Finally, Bernstein finally just threw up his head and said, you know what, pal, you're on your own.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was a matter of time.
Right.
And so they get to him in 37.
Yeah. At Thanksgiving of 37.
And where was that? At the deli?
Yeah. Boski's deli. I think that's how you pronounce it. Yeah. It's at 12th and Hazelwood. There was a very popular delicatessen there. Harry's in there partying with a couple of ladies and whatnot. And, couple guys just gun him down right there at the bar in front of like 100 witnesses. Of course, they also hit like 3 or 4 innocent bystanders as one.
Yeah.
One of Harry Millman's guys took a bullet that ended up dying a few weeks later.
Yeah.
According to underworld consensus is that two guys from Murder Incorporated were brought in from New York to do it. Pep Strauss and Happy Maione.
Right. Yeah. Pittsburgh Phil Strauss. Yeah. Is that his name?
I always call him Pep because that's what his buddies called him. But okay. Yeah, Pittsburgh Phil does a hell of a lot cooler.
So is this, I mean, in my book, I make the case that not only was this strategically in some ways the end of what we think of as the Purple Gang, but also symbolically that like anyone who was left realized that they had to play ball with the Italians if they were going to survive in the underworld.
Yeah, I think, I kind of take that same tack in my book that like the Purple Gang, like as an organized force, kind of somewhat ceased to exist after Harry Millman got knocked off. But they weren't done yet, though. Here's the thing. They had a lot of connections in like the upper part of Michigan state government.
Yeah.
Specifically with a Republican power broker by the name of Frank McKay.
Yeah.
And it's through McKay that what was left of the Purple Gang got mixed up in their last violent act. And that was the assassination of Michigan State Senator Warren Hooper in 1945.
Right. Yeah, that was a pretty, that headline generating, it was one thing to kill some, you know, pimp or gambler or something like that, but a political assassination.
Yeah, I mean, just the Hooper case alone would be good enough for like a movie.
Yeah, they gunned him down on the highway? Is that where they drove?
Where was it? I want to say it was... not too far away from Albion, because that's where he lived.
Yeah.
I've actually been to the spot.
Okay. Know,
yeah.
Did they drive him off? Did they, like, knock his car off the road or something like that? And then
of course, nobody was actually convicted. But, well, yeah, Harry Fleischer and his brother and a couple other guys went down for conspiracy charges. But the actual killing itself remains officially unsolved.
Yeah.
But basically what happened was is that Ray Bernstein and Harry Keywell, who by that point essentially ran Jackson Prison a hell of a lot more than the warden did.
Right.
Got out of prison for a day to do this murder.
Right, that's right.
And basically they were waiting alongside him in the highway and Harry Keywell moved the car into Hooper's path, skids, Hooper's groggy from the crash when Ray Bernstein runs over and blows his brains out.
Yeah.
And then they got in the car and sped back to the prison.
And why did they kill him again? What did it have to do with
He was going to testify against McKay and a whole bunch of other people because he had been paid money to, I think it was, tank a bill about racetrack totalizers.
Oh yeah, okay.
Those totalizing machines that, like, you know, ensure legitimate odds for betting.
So there's a lot of money at stake if he goes through.
Yeah, that was the lifeblood of like the top tier purple guys who were still around was that illegal gambling stuff at racetracks.
Right. So that was a lot of money at stake if that goes down. So just because that's probably the last major case study we think of as the remnants of the Purple Gang being involved in. But even though they really don't exist as its own syndicate, the guys who aren't in prison, the guys who didn't move away, it's not like the I mean, some guys like Joe Bernstein sort of go straight. He moves away and he kind of goes straight. But some of those guys, I mean, it's not like they went and got day jobs. I mean, there were still racketeers.
There were still a couple of tough guys on the streets of in like the 50s.
Yeah, right.
As a matter of fact, in that recent movie by Steven Soderbergh, No Sudden Move, I think, which was really good, by the way.
Yeah.
The Purple Gang gets a shout out. In fact, they might have even had a scene. There's a shooting in a restaurant that might have been done by faceless members of the Purple Gang.
Yeah. So that was, is that the movie about the auto industry kind of?
Yeah, it took place in 54.
Yeah. So some of the Purple guys, they're still around, and we know that in many ways they were working with the Italian mafia. And even as recently as like the 1980s, there were some Jewish racketeers around who were working closely with the Italians who were like kind of teenagers in the last.
Yeah.
In the last.
Candy Davidson, you know what I mean? Was one of the last of the last. Right. I remember when he got locked up. I remember last time I remember hearing something about him was in like 92.
Yeah.
When he was locked up.
And he was, we had Patty Naughton on our show, Shameless Self-Promotion. You can listen to our episode with former undercover DEA agent Patty Naughton. And she talked about Candy Davidson because of this history. She said even the Italian guys, like they showed him like deferential treatment, even though he's obviously not a made guy, he's not Italian, but he sort of had that kind of stature because technically his DNA, his gangster DNA could be traced back to the Purples.
I think Scott told me a story once. After Mikey Selleck got out of prison in the late 60s, I think this would be around like the early 70s. Mikey Selleck was like doing some bookmaking out at Hazel Park. And one of the young guys in the Detroit outfit at that time goes up to him, sees, you know, this old Jewish guy doing this, you know, unsanctioned bookmaking or so he says, tries to shake him down for some money. And Mikey Selleck basically tells him to go fuck himself. So this young Italian guys go back to, I think he went back to Zarelli himself to complain about it. Zarelli basically is like, leave that old fucking Purple alone. He'll kill you in a heartbeat.
Yeah. See what I mean? so they still had that kind of, kept that rep,
Absolutely.
even in the late days. So tell us about, so I already mentioned some of, Dan's books, Off Color, The Violent History of Detroit's Notorious Purple Gang. I love that book. I used it a lot
in terms of
my own research for my book. In fact, I was, and Dan and I are friends, so I've told him about this before. I was working on my book, and I was reading this, and I was like, he's going to get his book out. He's going to beat me. Because his book was so good. I was like, this fucker, he's going to... Because I could tell by your research. I was like, I know he could do an Italian book, too. I know he can. And then you did end up releasing the following book. Thank goodness it was after mine. But Venita, The Birth of the Detroit Mafia, it's just packed with information. I don't think there will ever be a work of scholarship that's more comprehensive.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Than this, in terms of the old school Detroit Mafia. But you've published a couple of books about the St. Louis stuff.
Yes, the Egan's Rats and the Gangs of St. Louis, which covers other gangs in St. Louis during Prohibition, like the Egan's Rats rivals, the Hogan Gang.
Yeah.
Their boss was a Missouri State Beverage Inspector.
Yeah.
The Cuckoo Gang.
Yeah.
Who actually started out as a baseball team, but they actually turned out to be some really powerful sons of bitches. Different factions of the Sicilian mob. They had their own names. They very autonomous. They were the green ones.
Yeah.
One of them was named the Pillow Game because their boss took a machine gun round through the ass and had to use a pillow to sit down. And there was the Russo Gang. They were Sicilian American bootleggers who, but the three mafia factions in St. Louis spent a lot of Prohibition fighting each other.
Yeah.
And they got into a gang war with the Cuckoo Gang and lost.
Yeah.
Which gave them a real big black eye with the rest of the bosses in the country.
No, I think that's one of the reasons why St. Louis never had the same stature.
Right. The bosses tended to look at St. Louis as kind of like the minor league.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Kansas City had a hell of a lot more pull than St. Louis did.
Yeah, because St. Louis, they're sandwiched in between Chicago and Kansas City, and those were serious players.
by the end of Prohibition, maybe even before the end of Prohibition, basically by the beginning of the 30s, by that point, the St. Louis family was little more than an extension of the Capone outfit.
Yeah, right.
The boss of the St. Louis family at that point, Frank Abate, was basically a Capone guy.
Yeah. And some of the St. Louis guys ended up in Detroit, too.
Yeah. That was the Licavolis, the Macheris, Bomberitos. Yeah, they're A lot of them got their start in St. Louis. Scarface Joe definitely
did. Camerata too?
Yeah, Camerata too.
Yeah, I thought so. So some great books about Detroit, great books about St. Louis. What's going on now? You have a forthcoming book, correct? Correct me if I'm wrong.
That one, my forthcoming is a straight biography of a Chicago gangster by the name of Frank McGurlin. His name might be familiar to readers who are familiar with Al Capone's story. Frank McGurlin was from the South Side. He's noted as the first gangster to use a Thompson submachine gun in Chicago, the city that made it world famous. He's also a cold-blooded killer who increasingly slipped into madness as Prohibition went on. He's notably killed his wife during an argument and shot her pet dogs as well.
Oh.
And among many other things.
That to me is unacceptable. I don't care about killing other humans. That's going too far. That's the first time now I'm out. I'm morally outraged.
Yeah, but this one is a real passion project for me. It's I wanted to try to make it a fresh, in-depth look at what is ostensibly familiar territory, and that is Prohibition-era Chicago. Guys like Capone, the Northside Gang, they're familiar to crime buffs.
Sure.
They are supporting characters in my book. And I deliberately keep it that way. I go in depth about other Southside gangsters like Joe Saltis, Spike O'Donnell, Danny Stanton, Ralph Shelton, and the Reagan Colts. You know, names that might seem familiar but have never been covered in depth. I want to give them a much more thorough examination. And I have. This book, quite frankly, is going to be huge. That's why I haven't released it yet. I'm still editing it down.
Okay.
I'm going to try to get it to a little over 800 pages.
Oh, wow. That's...
Yeah, you'll be able to kill cockroaches with my new book. That's for sure.
So would you say this is a biography or not necessarily?
It's a biography.
Okay.
It's a broad biography, but yeah. It's a biography.
Which will be interesting.
The focus is on Frank McGurlin. You basically will follow him literally from when his parents got engaged to the moment he took his last
breath. Were you able to find any of his surviving relatives?
Yes, I've spoken to some of his relatives. Yes.
Awesome.
Great people.
That's
and
awesome.
They were really looking forward to this.
And they were helpful.
In fact, they even said, you know, we've been trying to figure out for years why no one ever written a book about Frank.
Yeah, right. That's really helpful and useful. So it'll be interesting to read because up until this point, you've looked at organizations more like macro. It'll be interesting to read what you're saying in terms of a biographical, you know, sketch of a gangster. Now, are you at liberty to talk about... I know you and Bernie have some Hollywood things. Okay.
Mum's the word, okay, unfortunately. Okay.
So, but there, we may see you involved in some other.
Yeah, absolutely.
Other media, let's just say. We'll leave it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll leave it at that. Because, I mean, these stories are fantastic, and we only scratch the surface of, you know... looking at Detroit Prohibition era.
Talk all night about some
stuff. Yeah. But the 1910s, the early 1900s, the teens, the 20s, 30s, so many colorful.
Yeah. The Gianola Vitale war in particular is almost gothic. I mean, just the level of bloodshed. I mean, there was no diplomacy. It was just kill and kill again, betray.
Betrayal.
It's like a Lost Godfather prequel. That's kind of how I look at it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think something I've talked to Scott about is, and no one asked my opinion on this, obviously, but I felt that although I liked Boardwalk Empire, I didn't love it. I liked it. I felt like that was a missed opportunity. That show should have been about Detroit, in my opinion. It would have been a more interesting show to have that era. But Detroit, and you have the Purples and Harry Bennett ties to Ford Motor Company, and you got the Italians and the other, you know, stuff we're talking about, political corruption, the Detroit River. I think that would have been more interesting than Atlantic City.
Unfortunately, Detroit gets no respect. I mean, I understand. That's what's frustrating about this particular field. I know that New York and Capone are the ones that sell.
Sure.
That's why everybody focuses on them.
Sure, of course.
But there's just so much more out there. I mean, like you said, we could have based an entire series around Detroit in the old days.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. And I mean, I like Boardwalk Empire, but I mean, Atlantic City.
I did too. It wasn't perfect, but I there was parts of it that I really liked.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the costume design, set design were
the set,
first rate.
I mean,
that alone, it's worth watching.
Even though Stephen Graham's portrayal of Al Capone is completely historically inaccurate, I thought it was fun to watch.
Oh, yeah, he's a great actor.
Yeah, he's a great actor, but yeah, he turned him into a Tony Montana caricature. Well,
and also, I mean, how the, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, you probably know more about it than I do, but I'm going to say Nucky Thompson, but it's Nucky Johnson.
Yeah.
That was his real name?
Yeah, that's the real name.
I mean, he was sort of a corrupt politician, maybe racketeer. He wasn't a crime boss, right? Like, in that show, they make him out to seem like he was a crime boss.
I don't know the extent of his operation, but yeah, I think they did embellish it
a little bit for
entertainment purposes.
Right. I'm
not much of a stickler for that kind of stuff anymore. I understand that they got to embellish it.
I'm not either, but I'm just saying, like, it didn't help.
right. I think part of the problem what ended up killing the show is that badass set that they had of the boardwalk, which I loved.
Yeah.
It was destroyed by Superstorm Sandy.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
You notice at that point, that's when the story kind of shifts.
Oh, to New York, yeah.
Yeah, just to New York right. And Chicago.
I didn't think about that.
And Steve Buscemi basically becomes a supporting character in a show that's ostensibly about him.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's a good point. Well, hopefully we'll see more about this in the future. Dan, thank you very much. Is there anything,
you
have a website or anything to... where can people find your stuff? Just on Amazon?
Amazon. All four of my books are available on Amazon, and my next one will be published through Amazon, so be able to find it there as well.
Yeah, nice. Well, hopefully you'll come back again. There's more
absolutely.
We can talk about. We'll have Bernie in house. And in the meantime, thanks everyone for listening. Make sure you support us on social media at Gangster Podcast. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and every time you like it or share our post, you're helping us grow the show. So please do that. And thanks for your questions and comments. We try to, get back to you as fast as we can. In the meantime, we'll be back next week for Daniel Waugh. He's a great dude. Go buy his books. I'm Jimmy Bucciolato, Original Gangsters Podcast. Take care.